Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside me today is editor Simon Lambert. And coming up, is it time to make inheritance tax forms simpler and stop piling more misery onto bereaved families? Just when will the government pull their finger out on costly letting fees? We have victory for motorists over unfair parking charges. We tell you the 10 least reliable cars to watch out for and bust a couple of myths about flight bookings to get you the best price. All that and plenty more coming up. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, creating millions of reasons to celebrate every month.
Now, tax doesn't have to be taxing, as the old HMRC advert used to go. But it is. We even have an Office for Tax Simplification who are telling us it is. And one area that's particularly onerous is inheritance tax. Now, 10 times more bereaved families have to fill in a form than actually owe any tax. And the OTS says it can take over 100 hours to do. So firstly, Simon, welcome. Back in January, Chancellor Philip Hammond ordered this sweeping review of inheritance tax. Is this part of that review?
This is part of that review. And the first part of that review came out at the tail end of last week. And it's from the Office of Tax Simplification. They said in the first part, they're really looking at the administration and structure of the tax and what happens when people have to pay it, fill in the forms, what happens at death and so on. And the second part of the review is the bit, the juicy bit that everyone's waiting for, the bit where they might suggest some improvements to it. Now, if you thought inheritance tax was a bit of a mess, you should read through this report and you will see how much more of a mess it actually is than most people even realise.
What are some of the really messy bits? Like, what is the big problem with it?
OK, well, they say that sometimes a picture is worth 1,000 words.
Right.
In the report is a picture of all the forms that you need to fill out for the inheritance tax return. And this doesn't really work so well on a podcast.
Right, OK.
But I'm going to hold the picture up to you now and you will see this picture of all the forms.
Oh, there's a lot there.
Isn't
I like
there?
The picture of the little person on the side scratching their head. But the problem with the little person at the side scratching their head is a bereaved relative or loved one or family member or someone related to that person who's got a lot on their plate and has to go through all those
yes.
forms.
And you must realise that in order to fill out these forms, and I have had the misfortune of filling out these forms myself after my dad died just under 5 years ago, you also have to go off and you have to find out all the information to put in there. You have to work out the value of everything they had and so on and write it down and list it. And then you have to painstakingly go through the forms. And perhaps the most annoying part about all of this is that in many cases, you know that there is no tax to pay, that the forms that you are filling in are essentially meaningless. And I will give you an example of this. My dad left everything to my mum. There is no inheritance tax to pay. Yeah. So all I would have really needed was a form that said, did he leave everything to his spouse? Did he give any money away above this? And if the answer is no, you don't need to fill in all this information, because actually all of that nitty gritty about the value of his estate and even the value of his estate doesn't matter. It has no meaning for inheritance tax that will eventually be paid on it. What matters is how much that is worth when my mum dies, and then she leaves it because she's going to have to leave it to someone that she can't leave it to inheritance tax-free because her husband is already dead.
Obviously, you can get a financial advisor that...
You can get an advisor.
This,
you can get an executor, professional executor, but that costs a lot of money.
Especially if you don't have to pay
professional
tax
executors
anyway.
Will sometimes charge a percentage of the estate, and we've talked about this on podcast past, and that can be very, very expensive. You need to be very careful before you get a professional to do it. Ask them exactly how much they're going to charge and try to get them to do it for a flat fee. But this should theoretically be something that you can do yourself. This is not overly mentally taxing. It doesn't require particular knowledge. You don't need to be an accountant. You don't need to be a solicitor. There are ordinary people who are named as the executors in many, many people's wills, and they should be able to do it. What is galling is that out of the 570,000 deaths every year, there is something crazy like 275,000 estates that must fill in these forms. Yet only 25,000 of them are liable for inheritance tax. And this is because it has to be reported to the HMRC. Now, the Office of Tax Simplification made a big point of this in the report. It talked about the difficulty of filling in these forms, about how they could be more streamlined, about how there could be the kind of system. It didn't give the recommendations. What it's alluding to is there could be the kind of system that I just mentioned earlier,
yeah.
As in, is there any to pay? No, don't worry about all this nonsense. They also talked about the complexity of the tax itself. The page that listed how inheritance tax works was one whole page, bullet pointed. And it says a lot about something when it takes an entire page to describe how it works. And especially when you've actually had to miss out a bit of information to make it all fit on one page. But in short, inheritance tax is charged at 40% above a tax-free level of £325,000 for estates. That's known as the nil rate band. However, married couples and civil partners can pass their unused nil rate band onto the surviving partner on death, effectively doubling that tax-free amount to £650,000. A new residence nil rate band for homes passed on to direct descendants, children, grandchildren, and so on, is also being introduced. It currently stands at £125,000. It's on its way to £175,000 by April 2020. Money and assets given away more than 7 years before death are usually considered exempt, although they might not be, while there are also other reliefs, including a £3,000 annual gifting amount. And then there are other amounts that you can give to people for weddings and things like that. So you have to build up quite a complicated picture of someone's life to try and work out whether they've given away more money than they should have done, if they've given anything away. You've got to work out this nil rate band thing. You've got to add in the own home allowance. If you were going to design a tax, it wouldn't look like this. One of the other main complaints is that the exemptions available for lifetime gifts haven't risen with inflation. So, for example, small gifts, up to £250 per year to each recipient, cannot be combined with the annual gift exemption. So that's £250. That's about half a sort of low-grade iPhone. Any parents who have had to stump up any cash for a wedding, or anyone who has got married, will realise that it's not really scratching the full cost of a wedding nowadays. Normal expenditure out of income. This one is fiendishly complicated because actually you can override some of these other gifting amounts if you are giving money out of your income that means that your standard of living doesn't drop. So there has to be some conditions that are met. So if you've got excess income, you can give that away. But it's a very grey area and it's very difficult to work out what counts as this and what doesn't.
I'm just going to stop you, though, because I know that you've been through this process as well. So I say this with sensitivity, I hope, Simon, and also bearing in mind that you know the process. But you're an expert. And I just, in my head, am thinking about these families who are going through the most difficult time trying to figure out what on earth you're talking about just now. I mean, it's too much, isn't it? Right. And that's clearly what the OTS is trying to sort out. But what are the chances, really, of anything coming out of this? We have report after report. And if it is, when is it going to change? How can they make this simpler so that people don't have to go through this process?
Two elements there. One, I think that some stuff is going to come out of this, and I'll come back to that later on. Secondly, a reflection on, I know what I'm doing in a sense that I deal with personal finance stuff for my day-to-day job. But it's not necessarily the complexity or the difficulty.
Yeah.
It's finding the time.
Yeah,
it's true. It takes quite a lot of time because you've got to write to every single bank that they had an account with to notify them of the death. Then you've got to get the valuations back. Then you've got to compile all of those things, if they had investment accounts and so on. You've got to work out how much their possessions were worth. I mean, the personal possessions bit is just an absolute nonsense. The value of all their secondhand clothes. It's just a charity shop job, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, there must be so many people who spend at least 20 minutes thinking about that and then just go zero.
Yeah.
You know, but that's 20 minutes of their lives they're never going to get back. But I had to fill in these forms, but I also have two young children, a full-time job, and all these other things that you have to do. So actually, it's very time-consuming.
Is there something that, obviously you don't want to think about your death, but look, let's be honest, we have to.
Yeah.
Is there something we could champion or that people could do to get their finances in order so that, obviously, we want to make this more simple because it's too onerous and it's been said it's too onerous. But is there something that we as individuals can do to get our own finances in order for when the time comes a little bit better?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you need to keep all your stuff in one place. You need your loved ones and your executor, and those two things are often the same person, the same people, to know where you had all of these different accounts. Now, I was very lucky in that my dad was quite good at keeping records, keeping statements, and he had a file box full of stuff. If I got hit by a bus outside here today, whoever had to do it for me would be in trouble.
Well, let's
because I've got, you know, I live in a digital world. Yeah. I've got lots of accounts that people just might not even know about. There's nowhere that I've written all this stuff down, and I should do, because I should know better because I've been through this. But then there's other things like, for example, this £3,000 annual gift. Mm. You've got to work out whether the person busted that at any point over the last 7 years. And that's £3,000 in total that they could have given away. So if you, if you bought your son or daughter a second-hand Ford Fiesta and then had the misfortune to die within 7 years, the tax man could come knocking. That is preposterous, isn't it? So there are things you can do to help your relatives. Make sure, even if it's just you've got a notebook somewhere that you write down all the details in, do let your executor know that you have chosen them as your executor. We've talked about this when we did our wills podcast. There are quite a few people who just put someone down as executor and then don't tell them. If you do give away any large sums of money, if you do buy your son or daughter a £5,000 Ford Fiesta...
Other cars are available, by the way.
Other cars are available. The Ford Fiesta is the most popular in the UK. That's why I've used that example. So you write it down somewhere. Yeah. You have to keep notes, and it will make it easier for them in the end. Now, to go back to what you said, is it going to get any better?
Yes.
I would hope so, because as reports like this go... This one was pretty damning for such a report. Because it's this kind of report, it doesn't really go on the attack. But if it was expressing an opinion, it would not be happy with this tax.
Right, okay.
Okay. It's a fairly comprehensive assassination of something that has turned into a mess.
How's it got so bad, Simon? Is it just the way it's designed? It's just grown into this monster?
Well, yeah, because it's, I think, largely because it's sucked more people into its net, which we can come on to when we talk about one more big problem with this tax in a second. But it wasn't designed to catch ordinary families. Now, it doesn't actually catch 95% of the population. It's only paid by a small percentage, but that is going up. That is predicted to double. But it is catching within there a sizable chunk of people who are only in there due to the value of their house and the fact that they live in a certain part of the country. And so we're measuring their estates in a way that was designed to measure the estates of the very, very wealthy or the aristocracy or things like that. It was part of the idea behind an inheritance tax is to at least try and not break up, but do something about the very, very big estates. Mm. And this is catching people who are in it, who've just been successful, high-earning, middle-class people through their lives in it. So that's where I think some of the problem comes from. I think there's definitely an awful lot of simplification. If you're leaving everything to your spouse or your civil partner, for example, axe this nonsense. I expect there's going to be some recommendations around that. I expect there may be some recommendations to make these annual exemptions a bit more realistic. What I don't know whether there will be a recommendation is in terms of the percentage of the tax. That's what everyone's waiting for. Yeah. Is it just going to be raise it, lower it? People are a bit suspicious, so they think, oh, the government just try and find some way to take some more tax off us. Maybe they could do what I think they should do, is they should lower the tax. So from 40% to 20% goes from being, in people's minds, nearly half to not so bad. I think you'd suddenly start to find the very rich avoiding it a bit less. You might not even see the tax take come down. And you've got to bear in mind that there's this crazy situation where a tax that's only payable on 5% of deaths each year is the most unpopular of 11 major taxes and considered the most unfair. 59% considered inheritance tax unfair and just 22% fair. That was a YouGov poll in 2015. Wow. So hardly anyone actually ends up being hit by it, yet more than half of the population think it's unfair. Now, my argument would be, if you've got a tax like that, do something about it. But there's another problem that was identified. Actually, when you look at the figures, you discover that the very rich pay proportionally less. This has long been a suspicion of people who don't like inheritance tax.
Can I just ask you about this report? Is this the first time we've had anyone looking? Because, like you said, we've had suspicions about this for some time, but is this the first real in-depth, pull-it-apart dissection of this tax?
I think so, yes.
You've seen, certainly.
Official, yes. Yeah. I mean, you see reports put out by companies, often with a vested interest, financial companies and things like that, and they do some pretty good work on it. We run the figures before, you get HMRC data and everything, but this is a really comprehensive look at it. And what you find is that the average effective tax rate paid by estates rises from below the 1 million element, where effectively once you get this own home allowance in by 2020, you'll be able to do a million tax-free, rises up to about 20%. And that's at the £2 to £3 million bracket. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason why it isn't 40%, which the OTS did explain in there, is that because of the nil rate bans, the ability to pass to spouses, the fact that this is being measured proportionally against the value of all estates, it doesn't hit that 40%. It doesn't get near it. It peaks at about 20%. So it gets up to 20% at about £2 to £3 million. And then it plateaus until you get to about £6 to £7 million. And then the average effective tax rate paid by estates does something very strange. It starts sinking. And it sinks all the way back down to just 10% at £10 million plus.
Wow.
So what's going on there?
Right, exactly.
Well, this is the point where you start to get people doing things like avoiding, not evading, avoiding mm-hmm. the tax by holding assets in companies, holding funds elsewhere that they might possibly be able to keep outside of their estate in the UK. Buying up farmland is a very popular one. There are people, very rich people, very rich businessmen, who are buying up huge amounts of UK farmland because if the farmland is actively farmed, then it can be passed on free of inheritance tax. Now, the knock-on effect of that is that it makes it even harder for anyone who wants to get into farming. It is almost impossible to get into farming as a young person due to the sky-high price of land.
Yeah.
And one of the things behind the sky-high price of land is all the people buying it up for inheritance tax purposes.
Is this one of the things that we're looking at? Creative accounting, creative ways of doing it. Are they looking at these things properly?
And then, because there's another chart that goes with this, which shows the proportion of the net estate covered by an inheritance tax relief, excluding the nil rate band. And this goes from 20%, this is excludes the standard bit that you get. Mm-hmm. This goes from 20% of the estate in the 0 to 1 million bracket to almost 80% of the net estate in the £10 million plus bracket. So in the £10 million plus bracket, somehow people are managing to keep nearly 80% of their estates out of the inheritance tax net due to using some form of relief. So it's no wonder that people think this tax is unfair.
Yeah, absolutely. And now we really know. So look, in terms of a timeline, and I'm not going to ask you to give me the exact date, but you know what? We have reviews, we have reports, we have recommendations, da-da-da-da. These recommendations, what's the process that happens? Because we hear about these reports and these inquiries all the time, and it ends up being a bit of a fudge job, is that fair to say, for a lot of things like this? And like you said, it's so unpopular. More and more people are being brought into it as, you know, we go on. I don't know what's going to happen with Brexit, but this is going to affect more people as we go on, and we need to look at this now. So when is it likely?
We'll get the second report. Mm-hmm. And then maybe we'll see whether the Chancellor decides to do something in the what is now known as the Spring Statement.
Chancellor McDonnell.
Chancellor McDonnell. If Chancellor McDonnell ends up getting in, Chancellor McDonnell might have a very different view of how to deal with this.
That's a whole other podcast.
Yes. So the Chancellor might deal with it in spring or perhaps in the next budget in autumn. Now, obviously, there was a word that you mentioned there.
We don't have to say it again.
The B word, the Brexit word. It's pretty much dominating much of what the government's doing at the moment. It's very unclear whether we're going to get a deal voted through Parliament, be it the deal that looks like it's not going to get voted through Parliament at the moment, or some version of that, or Plan B, or this push now that's gaining more momentum for a second referendum, or maybe we're just going to have the Project Fear 2, the return scenario of plunging out on March the 29th into the dystopian nightmare of Mark Carney.
Yeah. It's all right, house prices will fall 30%. A lot of people will be taken out of the inheritance tax bracket.
That's true. Although, to be fair to the bank, okay, and I think sometimes they need someone to be fair to them. So they were positing the worst case
scenario. Yeah, yeah, no question.
And
about
it was to stress test the banks. But I don't know, if I was the Bank of England, I'd probably have learnt my lesson from the last time they said this. And maybe, I don't know how I would have played it, but maybe a little bit differently. But you see, you've got the Brexit issue. So are they going to do anything to change inheritance tax in light of that? Well, maybe if we do get a transition arrangement voted through and we have some certainty, then the Chancellor will feel that come spring, he could stand up and say, there is a mess. I asked these people if there was a mess. They said there is a mess. They said we need to change it. This is how I'm going to change it. Maybe he won't. Maybe he'll wait. And then, obviously, you then raise the prospect of if we were to get another government, a Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell government, they would have a very different view on inheritance tax to the Tories. The Tories initially promised under David Cameron and George Osborne that they would raise the inheritance tax threshold to 1 million. They couldn't get that through in the coalition. Then George Osborne fudged it with this own home allowance, which gets it up to 1 million, but it isn't really 1 million. And some people don't manage to benefit from that. The Labour Party have already said in their previous manifesto that they would remove that own home allowance. Maybe they would seek to tax inheritance more robustly. And there have been suggestions from one of the think tanks affiliated or that strongly followed by many in the Labour Party, the inheritance tax should be completely changed. And rather than you being able to leave an estate of a certain amount without tax being charged, everyone should have a lifetime amount that they can inherit, and then above that, tax is charged. And so the suggestion was that you might be able to inherit, for example, £125,000 over your lifetime, and above that, you would pay tax at your rate of income. Now, £125,000 is a lot of money, but if you think about it, considering the value of many people's houses, split a £400,000 house between two kids and they've busted that £125,000. And actually, that scenario could see a lot of people paying an awful lot more tax.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. For a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little. Give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.
Right, another area where the government has promised action is on letting fees. Yet 2 years after a ban was first announced, where the heck is it? And in the meantime, letting agents are still charging high fees. Now, Simon, you have one particularly awful story on your website about a poor young chap called Jamie. Just to give you a bit of background. Now, Jamie paid £180 to an agent to secure this new home in Bristol to live with his three mates. But, you know, really sadly, just before he could pay the deposit and move into this place, he discovered he had a brain tumour. He's 29 years old. Now, he couldn't move in, obviously. Went back to Leicester, lived with his family for rehabilitation and treatment. And his mates couldn't afford the property without him. But when they asked for a refund for this money, this £180, they claimed the letting agent ignored their request. They contacted you guys for help. So this, I think, Simon, is where you take up the story. And then we look at it in the wider context of letting fees. But Jamie, you know, we wish him well. This is a horrible story. But take up the story for us.
So Jamie got in contact with us because he said that they had not got the money back that they had paid to secure the property. When he couldn't move in, the friends couldn't afford to take it on themselves and they couldn't get another person in. So they took the sensible course of not going in there. They said that they had asked for their money back, but they had been ignored. We got in touch with the agent and after that, the agent, which is an agent in Bristol called B Streets Ahead, said that they would refund the money to them. Now, they did say to us...
But only Jamie, though, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
The other three didn't get this.
Yeah. Now, they did say to us that they hadn't been contacted, that they had heard nothing from them. We have seen an email that shows that Jamie's mum had chased this up. But I should say that Richard Manning, director at B Streets Ahead, said no further emails have been received from any of the groups, so their claim that they have requested a refund is simply not the case. We would, of course, be happy to refund in full on compassionate grounds Jamie's application fee. We made every effort to accommodate this group, and we at Streets Ahead feel that our policies are fair, certainly more so than the vast majority of letting agents in our industry. But it is commonplace to charge people some money to secure the property because otherwise people would say, well, we want the property, and then they might just keep looking for somewhere else and then just not move in. And that money is generally taken off ultimately your deposit or your first month's rent. So it's not unfair to do that. It's not unfair to say that it's non-refundable because if it's completely refundable, then the point of the fee is removed. However, you have to understand that in a scenario where there is a really good reason for someone not being able to move in, a really good medical reason for someone not being able to move in, then you should do the right thing and you should act with common sense.
But this isn't the only fee, though, is it? I mean, that's just one.
And this is the problem, is that this has become a sort of he said, she said argument going on here. OK, so that the group of friends say one thing, the agent says another. Fortunately, he now has his fee back. But the wider issue here is that there's been a lot of overcharging of tenants going on in the lettings industry, and that is largely in certain places where demand is very high and agents can get away with it. So the big cities, London, the big university towns, for example, you probably can't get away with it in lots of other places out in the sticks, for example, where there's just not so much demand to let a property. And it's not even every agent. There's a chunk at the top who've been doing a really good job of profiteering on people, charging people for stuff they're already charging the landlord for. You know, you're renewing your tenancy. Effectively, that costs them nothing to renew the tenancy. There's then a chunk underneath it who've been going, well, yeah, we'll do that, and then we'll add a little bit of money on top to make a bit of money. And then there's another chunk who've just been charging broadly their costs. And there is a cost in administrating things. You do have to bear that in mind. But what happens is the people who are acting more fairly towards tenants look at the people who aren't and are making loads of money off it and go, well, maybe I'll have a bit of that and I'll charge a little bit more. And the government has taken the decision that the best way to deal with this whole problem is, unfortunately, for the small minority who've been ripping people off, to spoil it for everyone, and they're going to ban tenant fees altogether.
When?
Well, that's a really good question.
That is the question, yes.
Because Philip Hammond announced this in autumn 2016, and it may not have escaped your notice that it is nearly Christmas 2018. I think one of the problems was the suggestion that there should be a whole-scale ban. There was a bit of a backlash against that, obviously, from letting agents who said, well, hang on a minute, actually, for some of these things we are legitimately charging people. And so it's just gone around the houses, and then it's been stalled by the whole Brexit thing again. So it's just another example of something that we've said we were going to do and we can't do because everyone's tied up doing something else.
All right, so the government may be dragging their heels over letting agents' fees, but they did deliver a win for motorists this week. Now, the Parking Code of Practice Bill was given the green light by the Commons, and it should give more clout to drivers to challenge charges from unscrupulous private parking firms. Now, the Tories promised to crack down on rogue parking outfits in their manifesto, and this certainly, Simon, it's fair to say, this is an issue that This Is Money have been campaigning for a lot recently as well. So just tell us a little bit more about the Parking Code of Practice Bill.
Now, this is good news because what it means is that people will have better rights when it comes to challenging the kind of tickets that they're getting in supermarket car parks, train station car parks, pubs and other locations. The Code of Practice written into the bill is expected to include a raft of new rules, a 10-minute grace period for drivers who overstay the parking restrictions, for example. Yeah, a £100 fine limit, and to make it easier to challenge these things. Now, unfortunately, what it will not include, despite bringing in new rules on inconsistent practices, substandard signs, confusing appeals and intimidating payment letters, is the DVLA flogging people's details to companies. Now, what is facilitating this entire industry that has mushroomed in recent years as parking firms go around and find people with car parks or bits of land and say, we'll stick some cameras up for you. AMPR, people drive in, we take a photo of their number plate. If they don't pay you, you stick some signs up. If they don't pay you, we'll send them a bill, we'll split the money. Is the fact that DVLA sells your details on. And that's something that's estimated to generate £16.2 million this year for the DVLA. I should point out that the DVLA claims that it is not making a profit on this. This is just how much it costs to pass on these details.
And we can't request for them not to, can we?
No, we can't. And that is what we want. Yeah. We want a break to be put on. We are not asking for people to be able to park wherever they want.
Yeah.
We are asking for a break to be put on this. Because do you know what would happen if the DVLA stopped flogging people's details? Is people who wanted to prevent people abusing their land and parking on it would have to employ someone to go around and put a ticket on their windscreen and take a photograph of the number plate and so on. You could enforce parking in that way, you just couldn't do it with this kind of machine-led ANPR thing that's going on. So there's a good thing there because it would mean less of this nonsense, people would be able to stop and park where they need to, and ultimately there would be more jobs to go around.
Exactly.
Even if they were people giving out parking fines.
Absolutely. All right, well, sticking with cars, listen up if you're in the market for a second-hand motor. So, Simon, you can tell us which are the most unreliable used cars. This is according to Warranty Wise. Okay, what are they looking at? How do you what's a dodgy car? How do you measure one?
Well, Warranty Wise is a company that sells extended warranties. So when something goes wrong with your car, you contact Warranty Wise if you've taken out a policy and you say, I think this is covered under my warranty and you need to cover the repair costs. Now, what that fortunately means they have is a huge amount of data of what goes wrong with certain cars.
Got it.
Now, nobody wants to buy an unreliable car. That goes without saying,
obviously,
doesn't it? There are some cars which do prove, unfortunately, to be more unreliable secondhand than others, and Warranty Wise has given us the list. Number one is the Range Rover Sport. So that's an expensive used car there. It's a premium used car. And the biggest fault was a suspension fault, average cost of repair, £540. Followed by a brake fault, £486. Number two, the Vauxhall Zafira. Now, the Vauxhall Zafira is a slightly controversial car because quite a number of them burst into flames.
Yes.
Gearbox faults, very expensive on those. The Vauxhall Insignia comes in under that. Well done, Vauxhall. Then you have the Peugeot 207, very popular, small French car. Unfortunately, can be expensive to repair, and a lot of them do have a problem and break down. Problems start to pile up when the car is 10 years and 2 months old. So you've got a long time.
I was going to say, does it make a difference that these are used?
Yeah.
That sounds a stupid thing to say. But
well, yes, the older a car is and the more it's been used, the more likely that a component in it will go wrong. Now, the problem is these aren't what are considered consumables in a car. So things that you will just have to change every few years. They're the things that are more expensive. So, for example, a gearbox fault. Theoretically, a gearbox should last. I mean, they say for life. It's not really going to last you for life. And the motor industry has a slightly different idea of what life is compared to other people. But you would expect it to last you a very long time. If you're buying a car and it's an older car with a high mileage, then you accept that something is more likely to go wrong. But things can prove to be quite expensive.
But I'm just wondering what it would look like if you had a top 10 of the most reliable new cars. So a lot of them are very reliable when the first 5 years, but there's something within them that beyond that time is less reliable.
Yes, and we've not directly compared those most reliable new cars to least reliable old cars scenario, but it would be an interesting piece of research. But you do tend to find that there are certain times when the cars that aren't so reliable used are also not so reliable new. But I'm not going to pick any out here
because I don't have
any data to back that up.
I think we got to number four, didn't we?
We actually got to number five, I believe, the Vauxhall Astra, an old favourite. Number six, the Mercedes-Benz C-Class. Number seven, the Mini Cooper. People love a Mini Cooper, but, you know, can go wrong. Number eight, the Seat Ibiza. This is quite interesting because Seat's Ibiza is the Spanish brand's answer to the VW Polo and Skoda Fabia, both of which have proved to be much more reliable, bizarrely, even though they're pretty much the same car. Number nine, the Fiat 500. People love them. And number 10, the Renault Clio. And your Renault Clio is most likely to have problems start to pile up when it is 10 years and 7 months old.
I'm also wondering as well whether it says something about the type of people that drive those cars as to whether they're likely to drive them in perhaps a more gung-ho manner, perhaps?
Or maybe not look after them. You need to find people who look after them.
Exactly.
So the most reliable used cars, we've got number one, Volkswagen Polo, number two, Ford Fiesta, number three, Ford Focus, number four, Ford Transit, number five, Audi A3, number six, Audi A4, number seven, Vauxhall Corsa, number eight, BMW 3 Series, number nine, Nissan Qashqai, and number 10, BMW 1 Series. The real key thing I'd say to anyone, if you buy a car, own a car, use a car, is if you really want to get your car to look after you, look after your car, and when something needs doing, pay to have it done. Because the longer you leave it, the worse it gets, and it has a tendency to cause knock-on problems.
All right, then. With colder weather upon us, we've done the cars. Let's do the planes, shall we? You might be dreaming of flying off to sunnier climes, but until the moment you are actually lying by the pool with your cocktail in hand, the dreaming stops and the stressful business of actually booking your holiday starts. And it is not helped by the total misery that is the way airlines price their flight, which is not helped by the fact that you will always find people who tell you all sorts of information, like it's cheaper if you go on a Tuesday, or cookies follow you around, so, you know, look up on one computer and buy on another, etc. So thank goodness This Is Money have gone through this. They've picked out the fact from the fiction and busting a few common flight booking myths for us. So Simon, I'm just going to run through them with you. You give me the answers. Number one, Is this fact or fiction? A search engine will compare all the prices and therefore you can get the best one available.
No, right. Not necessarily. The most likely to discover the cheapest flights in this research by cheapflightsfinder.com was Skyscanner, which revealed it 40% of the time. And then that dips down to Google, which revealed the cheapest flight only 18% of the time. We tested this out ourselves and found a similar result to what has been found there. But we also found that while most of the comparison tools showed the same flight as the cheapest, just with differing prices, some included other airlines that came out cheaper still. So do watch it, use a couple of them, and maybe look for the ones that you know operate on that route as well. A little bit of legwork.
Okay, number two, go direct to get the best deal.
This is not strictly the case. Often travel agents can buy in bulk, and that can therefore offer a cheaper price if they haven't managed to flog on the flights. So if you think that, for example, you might be able to pick up a bit of a bargain and there is a travel agent that you're going to a popular package destination, be worth trying a couple of the travel agents for flights only.
Okay, number three, airfares are as rare as hen's teeth. Explain this one.
Yeah, so what on earth is an airfare? These are when somehow an airline manages to offer a flight for the wrong price.
Like BA recently.
Yeah. Didn't it then cancel those ones
they canceled,
that it sold?
But
yeah.
Not mine, Simon.
Did
not
it
mine.
Not?
I managed to get mine. Yeah, a lot cheaper.
How much was your fare?
So I booked a flight to Qatar. All the others on the list were, I think, about between £500-£600. And there was just one outlier, £250. I thought that's an absolute bargain. But because I'd only booked 2 days before I actually flew out, only thing they discovered the day I was flying out. So I was all right. A lot of other people were not all right. But then a lot of other people were paying things like £1 or 1p. Mine, I think, because I didn't know where I was going, you could probably argue that that doesn't seem massively unreasonable for me to think that a flight could cost that much money.
No. No. And we got a tip here from the cheapflightsfinder.com people to find airfares. What you want to do is go to a site that allows you to do a broad search for everywhere, which Skyscanner, Kayak and Google do, and then just have a look down there to try and find some very cheap flights.
There
I mean, obviously, they that may... means you have to just take pot luck of where you're going. But, you know, if you can, for example, fly to New York for £205, you might think, well, hey, that's worth it. Go to New York.
Bargain. Yeah. All right, then. This is the cookie one. Clearing your browser gets you a better deal.
Yeah. This is the thing, isn't it?
Is this true? Do they follow the cookies round? So the airline company or whoever you're booking for can check that you're looking for a price and then they can keep bumping it up because they know that's where you want to go.
This is the great fear, isn't it? Dynamic pricing. That they're just going to screw you because they know that you want to go somewhere or you want to buy something. Not true, apparently, according to the guys at cheapflightsfinder.com. Their research said it isn't actually the case. In 60 flights searched, both cookies enabled and disabled, we found this made zero difference in flight price. We tested the theory and we also found the same prices. So
good. Oh, that's good.
Don't worry too much.
Yeah. Okay. And the final one, you're going to have to explain this. Spoofing your location can save you hundreds. What's spoofing about?
So you've got something that identifies where you were browsing the internet from. And the website can pick that up. So they might offer you a different deal in one country to another country. So if you use something called a virtual private network, a VPN, this effectively cloaks your IP address, makes it look like you're browsing in a different country, and you might be able to find yourself some cheaper flights. So according to independent VPN comparison tool called thebestvpn.com,
nice, snappy.
When it checked, the cheapest flight from Heathrow to LA from a UK IP address came out at £319. The same flight with a US IP address cost £303. Another example showed a bigger saving. A flight from Kuala Lumpur to LA with United Airlines booked in Poland cost £989.19 compared to booking from the US where it cost almost double at £1,839. But that's got to be a major outlier, I think. It's a lot of hassle to go to try and save a little bit of money. I doubt you'd be saving that much money.
Well, either way. Bon voyage, everybody. Now, thank you very much, Simon Lambert. Now, if you have a question for the team or something that you would like them to cover, Simon, how can people get in contact?
Email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk if you've got a problem that you'd like us to solve, A-team style. Or tweet us at thisismoney and come to the podcast channel, thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, where you will find the articles that we publish the podcast in, and you can join in the comments there.
And also, Simon, little word, you've got another channel going on relating to something with investing. So tell us about that.
Yes, our regular podcast listeners subscribed to our podcast will have discovered this week an extra cheeky little podcast thrust in there, which is the new podcast version of our popular video investing show.
So if you'd rather see Simon's face when this happens, you can always go online instead
yes,
of having a podcast.
Yes, you can watch the video, or you can also listen to the podcast. And we are starting up a new podcast channel, The Investing Show, which you'll be able to find where you get your podcast from, and you can listen to it there.
And what can we expect?
We interview fund managers, professional investors every 2 weeks and talk to them about how they invest, what they think the best investments are, what the ones they don't think are very good are as well. And we try to get under the skin of the investing world.
Tips from the top for free. Why not? Okay, don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. For a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little. Give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.